It's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America and around the world, 866-90-RED-EYE, redeyeradioshow.com. We stream live. Get our app. Put it on your phone. Listen 24/7. So I'm just reading some of the fallout. Oh, by the way, I'm Gary McNamara. Eric is not here, so me and you. Just reading some of the fallout from the debate the other night. This here from commondreams.org news. Audience full of rich people. $1,750 plus ticket prices for Democratic debate sparked disgust. Unusually loud booing and jeering directed disproportionately at Senator Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren during Tuesday night's Democratic presidential debate, particularly when senators criticized billionaire businessman Michael Bloomberg, sparked probing questions about the class composition of the audience packed inside the Charleston, South Carolina arena. Journalists and other observers pointed out to local reporting from February 6th on the Charleston County Democratic Party's offer of $1,750 to $3,200 sponsorship packages that included tickets to the debate and other events. This is something that the average person doesn't usually get to go to, said Colleen Condon, chair of the Charleston County Democratic Party, Total Local Television News Station. Citing party officials, the outlet reported that tickets are handed out to organizers like the Democratic National Committee, CBS, Twitter, and the Black Caucus Institute. Then they are first given to paid sponsors and handed to campaigns to pass out extras. Critics argued that the high price of admission may help explain why the crowd appeared more favorable towards Bloomberg. Bernie Sanders brought that up after the debate last night. Who will not even be on the ballot in South Carolina's primary on Saturday. And the loudly antagonistic crowd and response towards Sanders and Warren, both who were booed and heckled on several occasions. Sanders was booed for highlighting Bloomberg's strong and enthusiastic base of support among fellow billionaires. Warren was booed and jeered for pointing to inappropriate comments Bloomberg allegedly made to women employees. So I guess two billionaires running and billionaires in the debate audience. Oh, I love it. Well, what happens? This is what happens when you do what? What happens when you have victims and oppressors and you keep fragmenting the pie into more pieces, more victims, more oppressors. This is where you end up. So that's just, I love that. The other thing is, I'm just reading here, CPAC's going on for the next couple of days, the Conservative Political Action Committee, and it's a gathering of conservatives and people who claim they're conservatives. And I'm just reading here from Vanity Fair, at CPAC for Never Trumpers, loathing fear and a fight for survival. As Trump world parties at the real CPAC, Bill Kristol, Rick Wilson, and the rest are putting on the summit of principled conservatism where they'll game out their future if it still exists. It was funny because Eric and I were talking about this yesterday, and he said, so how much you want to talk about CPAC? And I said, well, I guess, you know, when we see some of the speeches there, but I guess it's always what we'll talk about, you know, at CPAC, and that's, you know, even from, if you look at recent history, Mitt Romney on, where I think Mitt Romney was introduced as what, the principled conservative, or some, I forgot how he was introduced, and Eric and I at that point, we laughed at the first time. We said, come on, he's not really a conservative. But as we said, at CPAC, look, they can do whatever they want. They can invite whoever they want. They're an organization that can do whatever they want. They have a private organization. And so it's fine with me. I could care less. But I'm fine if they bring in liberals. If it's conservatives wanting to talk ideas, well, then fine. Let's do it. If it's a huge party, well, go ahead. Do it. You can you can do in this country whatever you wish to do. Eric and I have talked about this in the past. Political labels, ideological labels, I can understand. I have no problem if somebody comes up to me and says, well, you know, you're a conservative / libertarian. And let's go through all the different issues and we can assign to you based on all the issues whether you really fit that conservative, you know, libertarian label. I understand that. Is the label the totality of a particular person? Not necessarily. It can be. It all depends. But when you get to political labels, you know, we've talked about the Never Trumpers who have gone from being, okay, I'm against Trump, and that's fine. If you sit there and go, look, I'm against Trump because of this, 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 and this, that's fine. If you're like Bernard Goldberg, who said, I can't vote for a Democrat, these people are basically nuts, but I can't vote for Trump because I don't like his language. And the thing that Bernard Goldberg was recently ticked about was him saying, calling, you know, Mini Mike. Well, that's fine. If that's how you wish to do it, fine. And people can judge you and say, okay, so you're against their ideology and where you could take, where they would take the country. You think that where Trump's taking the country is a good thing, but the language is what keeps you voting for him. And it's the ideology for the other. There's a lot of people that will look at that, myself included, and say, that doesn't seem to make any sense to me. But when you get into the political labels like the Never Trumpers, to me, I think that's, me personally, I think it's dumb. If you're an always Trumper, you know, if you have absolute political idolatry towards any particular candidate, I view that as a little dumb. Because as we all know, we've all been through it. How many candidates out there did you love and end up going, man, I think that person sucks after 8 years. We've all done it. We've all been there. You've all been disappointed in your candidate, right? Or your particular politician. How many times has it happened? Over and over again. So I figure, you know, why would you do the same thing over and over and over and over again and still continue to get burned? There is another way, which is what? You judge each and every politician by the substance of what they believe, what they say, and what they do. And you realize that there are different personalities everywhere. And Trump is a different personality. Trump is not a politician. I accept that. Tweeting is something that's relatively new for our society. It's only been around for a decade, right? Who knows how other politicians would have used Twitter 20 years ago, 25 years ago, 30 years ago. If Trump came in today and tweeting had been around and social media had been around, he might not be viewed as controversial as he is today. But reality is what reality is. And the fact is, Twitter is still new. And if you use it like the president does, well, nobody's ever used Twitter like this before. Well, that's because it really hasn't been around that long of a time. So not sure where you're going with, you know, with that one. But you can look at language. You all can make your own decisions, and it can be based on the substance of your argument on each and every issue. That's where the Never Trumper thing to me just falls apart. That's where political idolatry in general falls apart, if you want to look at both sides of it. I've never understood either. And I will admit at times I would sit there and be disappointed, but not that disappointed, because I know that I can't control what another person does. So what I look at, what I finally realized, and it didn't take long in my life to realize it, I'm an odds kind of guy. All right. Who's better when it comes to the final results? All right, okay, what do I do? And, you know, you've heard me talk about it before. Okay, I agree with that Republican. I really love the way that Republican presented something, but I don't agree with them about 50% of the time. How much do I really want to invest? You know, or you know, is there another candidate that can do it, even though I love the way that they speak? Well, what's the substance of their argument? What's the substance of the conclusion of what they finally get past? What is the ultimate end game of what? And that's how I look at it. And so we don't get caught up in the whole thing that seems to everybody, I'm not going to, you're an ever-Trumper. What? You can do whatever you want. You can be judged by it. But Bill Kristol, Rick Wilson, they look like idiots. I'm a conservative libertarian. They look like idiots. They look like just people that are just, I didn't get my own way and I'm angry about it. That's how it comes across to me. And I think both are extremely intelligent people who, because of them saying, I'm going to label myself this way, they have really lost any type of intellectual credibility. Because they say things and that they would never say before. And then you realize, you say, well, wait a minute. They're not basing it totally on the substance of what the person is about. They feel burned. Either their position in the industry has been moved or gone to a place where they didn't like it to go. Maybe they believe that there's been some political retribution, that in the business that they've been in, they've lost money or they've lost prestige. I don't know. I don't care about any of it. I've been doing this for 31 years, and I don't find anything different, because I learned when I became a talk show host just to talk about the substance of the ideas. I'm not going to be obsessed every day with Trump's personality, and we are. And I don't mean, you know, I mean we as a society is the left is, but those who also love Trump are caught up and love what he does and the personality part of it, and that's cool. You'll be judged eventually by other people based on the substance, I believe, of what the candidate eventually does. And so far, so good for Trump. Do I agree with all of it? No, you've listened to the show. You know you don't. But people aren't angry at us. Maybe temporarily they are. But most people, I think, even after the 2016 campaign, where we got the most flack for calling out Trump, where we believed he was not a conservative, I think most people have come back because they realize it wasn't being done in a childish or selfish way, or an attempt to gain recognition or power. And that's what you get out of a Bill Kristol, especially when you think about him and how much he has fallen. It's like, what's the point, Bill? And then when you start taking positions that are opposite to what you believed before, and some never-Trumpers have done that, well, I used to believe this way, but because of Trump's meanness, what the hell are you talking about? Nobody's going to change the way that I feel on the issues or the substance of the argument based on their personality or occasionally being crude. That's just dumb. And so, you know, with the whole CPAC thing, I'll listen for the substance of the ideas as I always do. And if there's a good speech, we'll play it. If there's a bad speech, you know, we might play it too. If there's somebody who's hypocritical, we may do it. But the CPAC convention, look, I think it's great. Anytime where people get together to throw out ideas back and forth is fine with me. And, the whole Romney thing, I'm still not sure whether CPAC disinvited him, because there's been a ton of different stories on that. But look, if Romney wanted to go to CPAC and speak, and they're about bringing everybody in, then they should do it. I'm never again. And if he gets pounded for it and booed for it, so be it. That's understandable. From anybody who views impeachment as an extremely serious federal exercise, and the fact that both articles were bogus, yeah, I'd be on his case too. But if you're going to open it up and say we want to hear from all sides, fine. If you just wish to hear from conservatives and conservatives only, that's fine too. So there you go. I just wanted to bring that up. And I know when Erica is back, hopefully tomorrow, that we'll probably, bring you some of the audio from CPAC. So there you go. And I'm sure a lot of people I know and are friends with will be there. All right, 866-90-RED-EYE.
Tires command a lot of attention. As a top expense for drivers and a leading cause of CSA violations, any tire maintenance practice that can help extend tire life is worth consideration. Consider tire balancing, which can set you up for savings and a smoother ride before your tires touch the highway. Tire balancing corrects an uneven distribution of weight in tires and wheel assemblies and offers benefits like improved fuel economy, increased tire life, and reduced vibration. Unusual shaking in the seat, cab, or steering wheel is a warning sign your tires might need to be balanced. If you experience this in your truck, stop into a TA Truck Service shop to have your tires checked by our team of professional technicians and ask about the benefits of their new counter-rack balancing beads.
This maintenance tip is brought to you by TA Truck Service. More bays, more expertise, more solutions.
Lines open for your calls. 866-90-RED-EYE on Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Hurley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. Eric has the morning off. It's you and me. Talked about everything from the debates to the primary coming up this Saturday to coronavirus. You name it, we've talked about it today. We head to you. Let's go to Ron in Alabama. Ron, welcome. You're on Red Eye Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Yes, there's a couple of things I'd like to talk about. One's how our schools, and I'd like for you to respond about it, how our schools, I believe, is teaching our children, have been teaching our children socialism for years, and trying to get see how they've covered up what Ronald Reagan was showing about a free market economy, you know, and capitalism. It's not even taught in the schools anymore. And
To address that point of socialism, I don't think they have been teaching socialism. If they've been teaching socialism, they should teach the history of Venezuela, which doesn't take a long period of time. I think what they're teaching is gimmeism. They're not teaching you the full aspect of socialism. We've said this before. Americans are not a socialist society. You think America, actually, if you could break down and teach them what happened to Venezuela over the last 20 years, when just as recently as 8-9 years ago, you had all the leading Democrats talking about what a successful socialist country Venezuela was. Remember that. I remember talking with Eric and going through the different Democrats and, you know, Michael Moore out there promoting this. See, if it's done the right way, socialism works. They're not teaching socialism. They're teaching gimmeism. We should be able to provide everything to everybody and everything's going to be okay. If you're truly teaching socialism and the history of socialism, you go through and you teach all the aspects. I have no problem. I was taught socialism in school. I was taught communism in school. I was taught capitalism and about a democratic representative government in school and our own constitution. It wasn't hard to figure out what was the best way to go, even as a young person. That would be my claim. They're not teaching socialism. They're teaching a perverted form of socialism, which focuses on the fact that we can provide everything for everybody and nobody suffers. And at the same time, billionaires must have done something evil. Because that comes exactly from the, as we've talked about before, the class envy, which is absolutely imperative for communism and socialism. But we're not teaching the history of it, because if we taught the history of it, people would say, oh, it failed. Oh, failed. Oh, failed. Oh, it turned into totalitarian society. But it started out as democratic socialism. What happened? Well, it's the government taking control, taking control, taking control, taking control. Taking control of property rights in a one-party system or a dictator or a majority of the population still is coming to the same conclusion. You're taking away people's property rights, and you're taking away people's rights, and you're taking away people's freedom and liberty. You end up in the same place.
They don't speak boomer. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley on Red Eye Radio.
866-90-RED-EYE. Welcome and good morning. Thank you so much for being here. Eric is not here this morning, but hopefully he will be back tomorrow morning. 866-90-RED-EYE if you would like to get in. Or actually tonight. That's right. He felt sick. He fell under the weather. He was here for the first couple minutes of the show, and as soon as he came in, it was like, I don't think he should be here. And so he struggled through the first segment and then said, go home. So hopefully he is okay. A couple of other news items and right back to your calls. You see, in Northern California has the first coronavirus case of unknown origin. It's a confirmed case. There's a one in Northern California. The new case brings the number of infected in the United States to 60, which includes people who have been repatriated to the United States. The CDC and the person contracting the virus without traveling outside the U.S. or coming in close contact with another infected person is from Northern California. CDC had previously said there are 12 travel-related U.S. cases and two cases of person-to-person spread, according to its website. The latest case brings the total number of those detected in the United States to 15. And it's going to be interesting to see where this goes over the next couple of months. Nobody has any idea. Nobody. They really, you can tell, they don't know. They're just saying, hey, take precautions because, you know, we don't know on it. So a lot of people want to take, you know, well, I think that's what it, you don't know what it is and neither do I. We don't. So not going to speculate on something that has to deal with sickness that I'm not qualified to talk about and nobody has the information and nobody really knows. And that's what you're dealing with. We can comment afterwards on it, but I don't know. And so should precautions be taken? Yes. Should there be mass panic? No. And I do think the president said the right thing last night when he said, look, we're dealing with this, viewing it as the worst possible scenario, but don't think it's going to be that bad. But we're preparing as if it would be. There's nothing more you can say. To harp on it, speculate on it, do conspiracy theories on it does no good for anybody, except maybe it makes our lives a little bit more exciting because we always like to claim that we know exactly what's going on. And I've got something, the inside information, when we really don't. And as the talk show hosts have dealt with it many, many times before. And yes, I will say this, Democrats are trying to make a political football out of it. And if you wish to say, Gary, that's an unfair statement to make, I can make that statement based on impeachment. And I will say it again to back it up. If they are willing to impeach on Article 2, which was separate from Article 1, we can debate Article 1, and we have before many times before. But for this point, Article number 2, when you have every Democrat senator and the vast, vast majority, was it 99% in the House, that vote to remove a president from office based on the president stating, I'm gonna go to the courts for my constitutional protections. Sorry, you get removed from office and we try to overturn a legit American election. If you do that, sorry, everything you do is based on politics and everything you do I can suspect is being immoral. Tell me where I'm wrong on that. Tell me why I should give them the benefit of the doubt. You can't. 866-90-RED-EYE. We go to Roger in Denver. Roger, welcome. You're on Red Eye Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to mention a poll, a Rasmussen poll, I just read that showed Trump beating Sanders 50% to 43.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's good 2020, but what makes me pessimistic about it is that 43% of the American voters would vote for a diehard Marxist, and that forebodes ill for the future, in my judgment. And old white guys like me are dying out, so it's going to be people who are sympathetic towards someone like Sanders are going to become more and more numerous as a part of the voting population as time goes on.
Well, there's a bunch. And, there's a bunch of There's a bunch of old white guys and white guys who will vote for Sanders.
So your
gender, your sex, your color of your skin has nothing to do with it. It's what's in your mind.
Well, yeah, but there is a statistical validity to saying that more whites will vote for Trump than Hispanics or blacks.
You could say that. It may be growing in a different way, but that isn't based on skin color. It's based on mind.
Well, yeah, but
even if demographics say that, is it the color of the skin that makes the difference? No, and that's why I say it's useless to even get into that type of discussion, because it's the mindset.
Yeah,
it can be the culture, but the culture exists. I will dare say this. I will dare say that if you look overall, if you want to call it cultural and mindset, if you look at the research that has been done on the conservative versus liberal mindset, that if you actually ask based on the issues, you will find that minorities agree more with conservative ideology than whites in the Democratic Party do. The most liberal Marxists that you will find would be whites in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I have to grant that. That's true.
Okay, and that's why I said, that's why we get into the nuances of that. That's why talk about the mindset. You can talk about the Democrat, but to do that, it really gets you nowhere. But yeah, I agree with you. The fact that 43% would vote for a Marxist, you say, what in the world's going on? Some will simply deny that that's the case. Look, the biggest problem in the country, I've said this before, is ignorance based on jealousy and envy. That was in Scrooge, wasn't it? What do we have to fear the most? Want and ignorance, correct? Ignorance and want. That's where we are. The gimmeism is extremely attractive. But ignorance based with jealousy and envy, that's what the Democrats are selling. We've said this for the longest time. And as I said the other day, we said this in 2016 when we got so many calls from Sanders supporters. Well, he's so much concerned for us. We said, no, he's not. He's immoral. Who in the world tells young people in a free society like the United States that you have no chance of making it and billionaires are your fault? Who does that? It's the same mentality that we've seen with Greta Thunberg. What kind of immoral human being, evil adult, starts telling a young person at a young age that they're not going to have an adulthood because climate change is going to destroy the planet? And they're not going to be able to live to be an old person, and they've got 10 years, and then it's done. It's irreversible. Who does that to a child? What kind of reprehensible human being does that? And you want to know the true difference between a liberal and a conservative, it's right there. They view that as a good thing that an adult has brainwashed a child into absolute paranoia about where the world is going. We conservatives view that as mental child abuse. You want to know the difference? There it is right there. So the problem with socialism, though, is we're not really teaching socialism. We're not teaching Marxism. We're not teaching the history of it. We're just teaching the gimmeism of it. And the Democrats know that, hey, these people are ignorant on it. They're ignorant. They don't care to learn. And we'll just play on those basic human emotions, the worst character traits we have of envy and jealousy and the sense of entitlement. We'll take envy, jealousy, victimization. That's what our political party will sell. That's what they're selling. And they call Trump immoral? 866-90-RED-EYE. If you would like to get in, we go to, Tom in Port Angeles, Washington. Tom, welcome. You're on Red Eye Radio. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Gary. How you doing?
Very good. Thanks for calling.
Anyway, about this congressional oversight debacle, I think what's got them scared, or at least spooked pretty bad, is that now we have a president that can actually juggle and play chess on the world stage. And it scares the bejesus out of them because they're losing control over how foreign policy can be made. And this guy's the best foreign policy president we've had ever that I can think of. And, you know, that's what's scaring them. And all I can say is, like, go, 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 Trump, and, grab that next caller.
Okay. But, look, I'll agree with you that he has been better on foreign policy than I thought he was going to be. But the jury is still out on that. We don't know. If he serves 8 years, he will have had a chance to really enact foreign policy, and we'll see how it goes. I like the direction of where I think he's going, but again, the results aren't in at this point. So I would not call him the best president ever for foreign policy because it's not complete yet. The course is not complete. So, but do I like where he's going so far? Yeah. Was I impressed with his presentation in India? Yeah. Look, one of the things about the president is that he's never been a politician. And there's a work-in period when you've never been in politics and all of a sudden you become a congressperson. There's enough there to begin with. You become president of the United States, it's a completely different ballgame. And so, yeah, wearing in the shoe. There's a time, and I think he's getting better at it. I think he's much more comfortable at it. But I can't make the decision. I can't judge the president on foreign policy and call him the best president in the history of all presidents in foreign policy until I see it come to a conclusion. And probably 4 years isn't enough. Probably 8 years, and then a few years after, you get to see how it all came to be. And, is it a possibility? It's always a possibility. Am I happy with what I've seen so far? Yeah, it's okay. Are there some concerns? Yeah, there are some concerns. Are there some things the president has said when it comes to where our troops should be in Syria and Afghanistan? Yeah. Do I understand the world is changing? Yeah. But it's still to be seen. Do I think troops should be completely pulled out of Afghanistan? Probably not. Do I believe that we should be negotiating with the Taliban and come to some type of deal where we trust them without absolute verification along every step of the line? No. But I don't know what the president has decided on that yet. So I can't come to a conclusion on any of those, Syria or whatever. He said a few things in Syria but didn't follow through on them. So I like that part of it. So there's not enough, I guess there's not enough of a presidential term, you know, for me. I like what he did with Iran. Getting out of the Iran deal was a correct thing to do. North Korea, still incomplete. We don't know. But that's been incomplete for the last, how long? Since the ceasefire was signed back in the 1950s, that's been incomplete all along the way. Will Trump solve all the problems? No. 866-90-RED-EYE.
We'll be right back with more Red Eye Radio with Eric Harley and Gary McNamara.
It's Red Eye Radio. I'm Gary McNamara. Eric is not here, so it's me and you. And since Eric isn't here, I almost forgot to do the 538 update, Nate Silver's 538 update on the forecast, the ever-changing forecast of who will win the Democratic nomination and the Democratic Party's nomination, not the Democratic nomination. Make sure I'm clear on that one. Bernie, Let me see. Bernie Sanders right now is in second place. Yep. Looking at it right here. The brokered convention back into first place with 44%. Sanders, 43% of winning the nomination. Biden, 11%. Bloomberg, 2%. Warren, 0.3%. Buttigieg, 0.1%. So there you go. The brokered convention is back in the lead over Sanders, Biden, and Biden.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or just starting your day, welcome to the show. From the Pilot Flying J Studios, this is Red Eye Radio.
All across America and around the world, 866-90-RED-EYE. I'm Gary McNamara. Eric has the morning off. It's you and me. We've had fun on tonight's show, have we not? Yeah, it's been fun. Should I say this morning show? Because it's technically this morning, not tonight. In the news,
we're very, very ready for this, for anything, whether it's going to be a breakout of larger proportions or whether or not we're at that very low level. No, I don't think it's inevitable. I think that there's a chance that it could get worse. There's a chance it could get fairly substantially worse, but nothing's inevitable.
That's the president last night holding his press conference on coronavirus. Look, that's really it. Most of the discussion that I've heard on coronavirus is people speculating, and everybody's speculating because nobody really knows how bad it can get. I think the president, when he said, look, we're preparing for the worst, but no, we just, you know, we don't know. Are there odds? Could it get worse? Yes. Might it not get worse? Yes. And so there's no evidence that it's, you know, a pandemic in the United States at this particular point or even worldwide at this moment. But it, of course, it is a concern. Anything else is really playing politics with it, as you see the Democrats do, as the Democrats immediately going after the president saying, how can this president handle it and give it to the vice president when they don't believe in science? They don't believe in climate change. And it's like, oh, stop it. So that's basically where we are right now. And the rest, I guess we will see. In other news, I'm also play this audio cut here because it's quick. In other news, the Democrats continue to campaign as the South Carolina primary is right around the corner.
It was my mistake, and I apologize for it. I've asked for forgiveness, but I can't rewrite history, and I've got to make sure we don't do it in the future, and hopefully my successor has learned the lesson.
And that's Michael Bloomberg, of course, still defending himself on a stop and frisk. The reason I played Bloomberg was when you look at the overall, when you look, for example, looking at the California poll that came out, Bloomberg not faring well in California with the primary coming up for Super Tuesday next week. And on the overall, he seems to have, he has dropped again. He's down to almost below double figures. So it looks like, you know, Bloomberg, the traction that he thought he was going to get from all the commercials that he ran were blunted by his performance, especially in the first debate, and nothing really coming out that made him shine in the second debate. So there's where we are now. Bernie Sanders getting a lot of criticism, even from other Democrats, about how he would fund all of his plans that he has mentioned that he would do, everything from Medicare for All to free college. On Medicare for All, he's taking a hit because on the debate stage the other day, he said that in a study, he responded that a study that just came out of Yale University, published in Lancet magazine, one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, the result showed that his plan would save $450 billion a year and 68,000 lives. And that's the end of the story until the fact-checking started. Reason Magazine, the libertarian publication that does a great job and brings up a variety of different opinions and different issues, many that I agree with, some that I don't agree with. But they analyzed Sanders' statement and said the study was co-written by a former unpaid Sanders advisor. A detailed article produced by Kaiser Health News and PolitiFact, however, rates Sanders' claim as mostly false. The true part of it is the study does exist. The false rating comes from the story's conclusion that the Lancet study's major findings are wildly disingenuous because they ignore or discount much of the evidence about what effect such a program would have on the healthcare system. The study assumes, for example, that the Sanders plan could pay Medicare rates across the board. Medicare rates are far lower than private insurance rates, and the hospital lobby is a powerful political force that has successfully fought off payment reductions in multiple venues. When Washington State set up a government-run health insurance plan, lawmakers ended up boosting the rates to 170% of what Medicare pays. The Lancet study Sanders cites also lowballs a likely increase in utilization that would come from eliminating co-payments and other cost-sharing mechanisms, as Sanders' Medicare for All plan calls for. Although it allows that the newly insured would use more care, it assumes that the currently insured would not seek to use more health services. As Harvard health policy researcher Adriana McIntyre points out, that's just deeply unrealistic and in the real world is shown to actually not happen. So there you go. I mean, that's just the beginning of it. And so that's the problem that one of the problems that Sanders is going to have across the board on this when he keeps promoting Medicare for All is the devil is always in the details, is it not? And so when he saves all this money, it's making what? Assumptions based on what? Assumptions that don't happen in the real world. And history shows when actually applied does not happen. In other news, a Trump campaign has filed a libel lawsuit against what it calls an extremely biased New York Times article saying the paper's March 27th, 2019 op-ed titled "The Real Trump Russia Quid Pro Quo" amounted to a knowingly false smear intended to, and this is the part of the lawsuit I like the best, intended to, quote, improperly influence the presidential election in November of 2020. They did a bad thing, Trump said at the press conference on Wednesday, before promising more litigation. There will be more coming. There will be more coming. The lawsuit seeks compensatory damages in the millions of dollars, as well as punitive damages and legal fees. Knowing that then special counsel Robert Mueller was about to exonerate President Trump, the campaign argues in the lawsuit, the Times sought to quickly damage the president's campaign before the Mueller report would be released, debunking the conspiracy claims. Quote, today the president's reelection campaign filed suit against the New York Times for falsely stating the campaign had an overarching deal with Vladimir Putin's oligarchy to help the campaign against Hillary Clinton in exchange for a new pro-Russian foreign policy, starting with relief from economic sanctions, senior Trump campaign legal advisor Jenna Ellis said in a statement. Those statements were and are 100% false and defamatory. The complaint alleges the Times was aware of the falsity at the time it published them, but did so for the intentional purpose of hurting the campaign while misleading its own readers in the process. In the statement, the Times shot back, the Trump campaign has turned to the courts to try to punish an opinion writer for having an opinion they find unacceptable. Fortunately, the law protects the right of Americans to express their judgments and conclusions, especially about events of public importance. We look forward to vindicating that right in this case. Lawsuits for libel against media organizations by public figures must clear a high bar and require a showing that the media organization was reckless in reporting a falsehood, meaning either that the organization knew the information was false or intentionally disregarded a significant risk that the material was false. Opinions cannot be defamatory. Trump, speaking at the press conference of the Times article, crossed the line by making false factual assertions. The constitutional guarantee requires, we think, a federal rule that prohibits a public official from recovering damages for a defamatory falsehood related to his official conduct unless he proves the statement was made with actual malice, that is, with the knowledge that it was false, or with reckless disregard of whether it was false or not. The Supreme Court has held in the 1964 landmark case, the New York Times against the Sullivan. The March 2019 op-ed piece, published shortly before Mueller's findings became clear in April of 2019, asserted that there was no need for detailed electoral conclusion between the Trump campaign and Vladimir Putin's oligarchy because they had an overarching deal, the quid of help in the campaign against Hillary Clinton for the quo of a new pro-Russian foreign policy, starting with relief from the Obama administration's burdensome economic sanctions. The Trumpites knew about the quid and held out the prospect of a quo. Times obviously had a malicious motive, the campaign charge, because the paper published numerous articles in 2017 and 2018 that established only isolated contacts between individual Russians and some persons associated with the campaign, which did not result in any deal or any quid pro quo. Nevertheless, the alleged 2019 defamatory article did not present those findings. So there you go. We'll see where that goes. As you know, I mean, it's completely false, completely and totally false. It's whether they can help the op-ed writer. And they don't say who the op-ed writer was in that. That's the interesting thing. Why not? In the Fox News article, I don't see it here. So, we'll see where that goes. In other news, the second Court of Appeals, Circuit Court of Appeals, gave the administration a victory in the Sanctuary City fight, saying the administration can deny grant money. Saying, hey, Democrats and Republicans all passed these laws that state that the federal government controls illegal immigration. Anything to do with illegal immigration, they control. The Supreme Court has backed that up. They actually write it in there. The Supreme Court backs it up. You and I both remember the Arizona Supreme Court decision when they came out and said, look, local law enforcement can't even help the federal government with enforcing illegal immigration unless the federal government says it's okay. Since the federal government has complete control of it, well, then you've got to abide by it. If they say don't help us, you can't help them. And as we stated at the time, this may come back to bite the Democrats because the Democrats are working with sanctuary cities against the federal government. So if they can stop them, even if they're helping the federal government without the federal government's permission, certainly they could punish them if they're not helping. And the court agreed and said, absolutely. Might this go to the Supreme Court? Yep. Your calls and comments coming up, 866-90-RED-EYE.
USDA's top official for food safety, Mindy Brashears, points to a finding that disturbs her.
In all the studies that people were supposed to wash their hands, either before preparing product or at the end or after they touched the meat, only two people out of the 1,100, almost 1,200 times, did people actually properly wash their hands following all the steps.
So how does she feel about this?
This is alarming to me because I think people should learn in, you know, kindergarten how to properly wash their hands. Washing hands is not just a food safety issue. It is a very widespread public health issue.
For example, officials are recommending better hand washing as one way to keep illnesses like COVID-19 from spreading.
Wash your hands, wash them properly. Use soap, dry your hands. You know, people would rinse them or just wipe them on a cloth. And there are certain steps you need to follow when you wash your hands.
She spoke at USDA's annual Agricultural Outlook Forum. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The USDA report is brought to you by Cenex Roadmaster XL Premium Highway Diesel Fuel.
Get in touch with Red Eye Radio, toll free at 866-90-RED-EYE.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Carly, and I'm Gary McNamara. Eric has the morning off. The Fox News article did say who the op-ed piece was written by in the New York Times, that the campaign is suing the New York Times over. It was written by Max Frankel, who was the executive editor of the New York Times from 1986 to 1994. Now, here's the thing. You're saying, well, it's an op-ed piece. You still have to, you cannot. If you're a publication, you can't just let somebody put in an op-ed piece with completely and totally false information and sit there and say, well, it's an op-ed piece. We had nothing to do with it. Can't do it. If you know it is, you know, if it defames somebody's character, if it's slanderous, you know, you're not supposed to do it. The only thing would be that the president is a public figure. Opinion is one thing. Stating facts is a different thing, and I'm sure what they'll play on in this op-ed piece is, look, this is somebody who worked for the newspaper. This isn't a letter to the editor. This is somebody who actually worked at the New York Times, giving it actually more credibility to the readers because this was a former executive editor. So I can see where they're trying to go here. But the whole thing is false. He actually says in there, and we knew at the time it wasn't, he makes the things that the Russian oligarchs were the ones that got the Russians to lure the Trumpites to a meeting in the Trump Tower with the promise of dirt. We know that's not true. That's not why the Russian lawyer was there at all. So there's no evidence to that at all. So making stuff up, and remember, this was right before the special counsel report came out. So, I mean, they have a case. Did the New York Times know that this op-ed piece was false? Absolutely. How high will it go to the level of the president's a public figure? And how do you prove that it was malice is another issue that I really don't know, because I don't know what evidence the president's lawyers will bring as opposed to the defense from the New York Times. So I guess all I can say is we shall see. 866-90-RED-EYE. Teresa, Greg, and more. Your calls and comments coming up following the bottom of the hour. If anybody else wants to get aboard, we would love to hear from you. The final thing is, did you see Bernie Sanders and now other Democrats complaining about the debate in South Carolina the other night? That so many of the tickets were sold to high-end donors, and that's why Sanders and Warren, this is the narrative they're trying to play here, that's why Sanders and Warren were getting booed, is because these were all the billionaire friends of Bloomberg. And so that's why, remember the one, when was Sanders talking about? Was it Cuba, remember? And there were some, and he's like, really? Really? Really now? And Sanders was upset after the debate and talked about it. Said, this is unfair. It was rigged. 866-90-RED-EYE. It's time for your national forecast.
A snowmaker in the upper Midwest and Great Lakes will continue today, moving on into the Northeast, and then by later tonight and into Friday, things will eventually be winding down, but not until portions of upstate New York receive plenty of snow. Along Lake Erie, we'll continue to see the snows fall down in toward Cleveland. And the way this particular low-pressure system is moving to the north and east, we'll see that cold air develop in out of Canada, push snowfall into the states of western PA, portions of West Virginia, the Laurel Highlands of Maryland, and some icing as the system trails into the lower Tennessee Valley, where it picks up some precipitable moisture. The system will stay north and west of Boston, where it looks like this will just be a rain event. The I-95 corridor will escape the snow. The deep south, center part of the country, and the west, mainly all dry today. And there's your national forecast from Red Eye Radio. I'm meteorologist John Trout.
It's a No Malarkey Morning. Eric Harley and Gary McNamara. Red Eye Radio.
And I'm Gary. Eric has the morning off. He's not using that anymore, is he? I guess that didn't wear well. 866-90 Red Eye. Let's head to you. We go to Teresa in Chicago. Teresa, welcome. You're on Red Eye Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for calling.
Excellent. I believe freedom and liberty is most important, and I think people have a tendency to take that for granted sometimes. But, you know, put the socialist supporters under a communist regime, and I wonder if their thinking would change if they were under that regime.
Well, they're the first ones that don't want to be told what to do or how to lead their lives, yet they're supporting a system that would end up getting them exactly to that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a combination of want and ignorance, as we said earlier, that is highlighted by the Democrats promoting jealousy and greed, that those billionaires have done something evil. I mean, that's the ultimate way to do the victim oppressor. Those billionaires are evil. They did something that was wrong. They got to that point. Nobody should be able to get to that point. They did something wrong, and they're screwing you over. That's classic. It's classic jealousy and envy. But you do it by promoting free stuff and that you're a victim. You'll be a victim all right under that system eventually. I said this yesterday, because I say it every once in a while, and when talking to Eric yesterday, this gets beyond politics. It gets to the human spirit, the autonomy of a human being in general. It's actually bigger than just the day-to-day politics. I am so happy that I was raised the way that I was raised. I am so happy that freedom and liberty are the most important thing to me, and there isn't even a close second place. And it's the way that I was raised. And I am so grateful. I'm not grateful for free stuff. And because I know, okay, we've heard that before, but it's true. Freedom isn't free. It was fought for me. The freedom and opportunity that I've had my entire life was fought for. That wasn't free. Somebody sacrificed in order for me to have it. And everything that happened to me, the good, the bad, whatever, I've always been fine with. Because what I wanted was freedom and opportunity. I wanted that chance. Did the unknown drive me? Did fear drive me? Yeah. I know I'm preaching to the converted. It did for you too. I know. All of you. It did for you too. I look at this, the society today, I can't imagine actually buying in. I really wonder whether I or a lot of you could be brainwashed, or whether you need to have a particular mindset in order to buy into the brainwashing that something is free and we're actually going to take care of you. I'm so cynical that I'd never believe that to start off with. Oh, it's all going to be free and nobody's going to have to pay for anything? Oh, yeah, that's really going to happen. Come on! The surveys that are taken, and it was used, I saw it on social media the other day. Well, Bernie Sanders has brought up the the Nordic countries, and I did the research, and in the happy surveys, they're the happiest. Well, define happy. I don't know what happy is. It's different for each and every person. Happy for me is freedom. Now, it's a long-term happiness. It's a long-term contentment. But when you choose your happiness and the definition of your happiness, if freedom and liberty, you know through that freedom, the ultimate long-term happiness that you are looking for is not based on security. And if you look at those countries when they say, well, yeah, the happiness is based on the fact that healthcare is taken care of, this is taken care of, this is taken care of, this is taken care of. Well, I couldn't look at that and ever view that as happiness, because the premise would be wrong for me. Because I would understand that to have all of those things guaranteed by the government, there's going to be a cost, and I'm not going to like that cost. So is it superficial happiness that we're talking about? Is it actually critical thinking happiness? Or is it looking at life in general and saying, what will make me and what will make society the best human beings out there? People that are adventurous, people that have a lust, love for life, want to live every day, want to climb mountains every day. Well, that's part of the incentive of capitalism that we talk about. But the incentive isn't always just money. Money's a part of it, but that's not bad. Money brings you freedom. Money and freedom brings you the ability to be able to make your own decisions. Nobody else makes a decision for you when you have the money. If somebody else has the money, then they make the decisions of how they're going to allocate that money to you. Which is why I'd say, well, no, I'd rather have the money and the freedom and take the gamble and all of that. Now, social safety nets for people that truly need it, that I can understand completely. How we do that is actually the great debate between conservatives and liberals. It's not that conservatives don't wish to do it. It's that they view the federal government as the wrong way to do it. Democrats and liberals will look at that and say, well, if you don't want the federal government to do it, you don't care and you want people to die. Of course, that's ridiculous. That's not it at all. It's how to allocate that. I learned that from my father. I don't know if my father does it any longer, but my father, up to a few years ago, all the time would go down to the homeless shelter and my father would always bring food. He wasn't one to give cash to people that were homeless on the side of the streets, knowing that, hey, I don't want them. I don't want them to be able to. I'm not going to enable their habits. I'm not going to do that or their addiction. But my father is the one. That's why. What was it? Was it called compassionate conservatism when Bush came out with that? My father didn't like that. I didn't like that. Because part of being conservative is being compassionate to begin with. Adding that word on was redundant. My father and my mother taught me. I have an absolute responsibility to give back to society. Being in Boy Scouts taught me that. My church taught me that. My neighborhood taught me that. It's how you do it. Do I have an obligation? Yeah, I personally believe I do. Many people don't. I believe I do. That's how I was raised. It's my obligation and responsibility to help take care of people who can't take care of themselves. but it's how you allocate that. It's what the best way to do it. And so, you know, when you look at it, when you look at freedom and liberty, I find it hard to get out of the mindset and try to put myself in the brain of anybody else on the other side who believes, actually buys into the fact that everything's going to be taken care of them, all their needs and wants are going to be taken care of. Because remember where the left is going. Gavin Newsom saying housing now should be a prescription. So housing is a right. Food is a right. Water is a right. Transportation. We see the riots. We should be able to ride the subways for free. Transportation should be free. Housing should be free. Education should be free. Everything across the board should be free. And the government should provide it for you without thinking any farther beyond that part of it. That's what we're teaching in our schools. We're not teaching socialism because we're not teaching the other half of how you get to that point. And then how are you controlled? And how are you taxed? Because nothing is free. Number one, I don't think I'd ever be that big of a sucker or gullible enough to believe the government could provide everything for me without there being a serious cost. Number one, I just wouldn't buy into that. I'm too cynical. And justifiably cynical. Why? History has shown me it never happens that way. And number two, I can't imagine going through life believing that I'm a victim. That's completely foreign to me. That's so foreign to me, I can't even imagine that. By the way, I was a little shrimp who was bullied. Even then, I didn't think I was a victim. It was just, oh, I got to find some way to strike back. And I always did. And I think most of you think that way, too. That's why most of you are conservative. You think that way. You're not a victim. You don't want anybody to view you as a victim. Now it's a badge of honor. You're a victim. They're an oppressor. We are a two-party major system. We're more than a two-party system. It's just there's two major parties, and one major party is preaching that you're a victim of an oppressor and that you can't make it unless somebody takes care of you. I didn't think that in my first job of cleaning toilets, of working two jobs to go to college. Never thought about it, and never have thought about it till today. Didn't think about it as a child that way. Didn't look at life that way. Have never looked at it that way. It's a foreign concept to me. The fact that that has been embedded and planted and has grown in a significant portion of our society today, to me, is the most reprehensible and immoral thing that we could have done and passed on to young people, to the next generation. Just completely and totally unacceptable to me. And I know it is to many of you too. But that's what the bigger thing is for me, besides the day-to-day politics, besides using the words of, you know, socialism, capitalism, democracy, communism. It's what it does to the individual mind. And knowing how my mind was trained, but it was trained to do what? It was trained to understand freedom and learn to work with opportunity and learn to handle my fears and my phobias and get them under control. And truly always attempt to learn and understand more about life, but not going through it with the philosophy that I'm a victim and somebody else needs to take care of me. It may happen. It could happen to people. And those safety nets should be there. And as I explained earlier, it's how you implement those safety nets, which is really the discussion between the conservatives and the liberals. Not conservatives, I care because I'm willing to spend taxpayer dollars, and conservatives want you to die, because that isn't the case. All right, 866-90-RED-EYE.
There's a new Shell Rotella engine oil for gas engines. Shell Rotella Gas Truck is available now. Megan Pino, Shell Rotella Global Brand Manager, tells us what was behind the development and more about the product.
Obviously, Shell Rotella's heritage is heavy-duty engine oil, and that will remain our heritage. And we know that our customers work hard, but they also love to play hard. And many of our customers also own a gasoline-powered pickup truck, SUV, and perhaps as a personal vehicle or as part of the business. We also know that truck owners use their trucks for different purposes than a car, to be able to tow something, whether that's an RV or a boat for fun on the weekend, for, you know, your business, for hauling equipment. So you're doing something different with your truck than you are with a car. And so why use the same motor oil that you would in your car as your truck? There are three viscosity grades, 0W20, 5W20, and 5W30, which covers any gasoline-powered pickup truck or SUV in terms of the manufacturer recommendations.
For more, go to Rotella.com. This engine report is a service of Shell Rotella.
Coming up, more with Gary McNamara and Eric Harley. It's Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. Hopefully Eric's back tomorrow. I'm Gary McNamara. He got a little under the weather there, so hopefully he's doing okay and is back for the show tomorrow morning, because I remember to look at Nate Silver's 538, but he's the one that really, every day, did you see it again? And he's checking it like every hour to see if they updated it. But right now, because everybody, I get more emails on this, hey, check it out for us. Even on Twitter, check it out. What's going on? Brokered convention is back in the lead, 44% to Bernie Sanders, 43%. Then Biden, just 14% chance. And then everybody else, 1% or less, or 2% or less right now. Chance of, that's the forecast for who's going to win the Democratic nomination. But I'm sure we'll go over the latest polls right before South Carolina on Saturday, then Super Tuesday next. When is it? Super Tuesday. Next Monday, Wednesday? Tuesday, yes.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One.